The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, The Fee Fight Back. Increasingly, attorneys across the Triangle face clients asking to ditch pricey hourly rates. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, The Changing World of Attorney Fees. And this article is written by Jennifer Henderson. The billable hour. It can be a frightening yet frequent phrase in many a general counsel's vernacular, particularly those tasked with reducing their company's legal spend or seeking more transparency when it comes to the billing process. Traditionally, the billable hour is the main way law firms charge their clients. But for businesses, those costs can be difficult to understand and can add up quickly. In the Triangle, hourly billing rates can range from south of $200 to $600 and even higher. A few elite attorneys in major U.S. legal markets charge around $2,000 per hour. During and after the Great Recession, increased need for cost reduction and predictability when it comes to legal services led to a new rise in alternative fee arrangements, AFAs, even though the concept has been around for decades. Now, years after the recession, the use of AFAs is becoming more and more a part of the conversation between law firms and their clients. Over the recent years, we are seeing and using AFAs more so now than we have in the past, says Gerald Roach, managing partner of Raleigh Smith Anderson Blunt Dorset Mitchell and Jernigan. He adds that types of AFAs used by his firm include fixed fees, success-based fees, volume discounts, and flat retainers. What remains certain is that clients are driving the demand for alternative forms of billing when it comes to legal services. According to the 2017 Law Firms in Transition survey from legal consulting firm Altman Weil, 93% of firms report they use some form of non-hourly based billing. And this shift in pricing is squarely because of competition. Another Altman Weil survey in 2009 found that only 42% of firms believe that law firms trying to price out each other would be a permanent trend. Today, 95% of firms believe they will compete with law firms through pricing mechanisms. And that may be the primary reason why AFAs are beginning to become a norm. Of course, that means Triangle Law Firm's revenue intake likely will slow down or even drop, forcing the legal professional to cut down on costs. That in turn could affect services such as real estate renewal deals and force law firms to leave high-ticket rental areas. The Triangle is home to plenty of startups and companies in the life sciences space, two areas where companies often seek AFAs. And established firms in the Triangle, such as Smith Anderson, Parker Poe and Ward, and Smith, say they are devoting increasing chunks of work to the new arrangements. At Parker Poe, one attorney says more than a fifth of the firm's client relationships involve AFAs. Lawyers have been a little bit lucky for years, and now clients have said, we've got to get a handle on these fees, says Tom Clay, a principal of Altman Weil and UNC Chapel Hill graduate. And this idea is not irrational or disloyal, he adds, rather simply a desire by clients to feel like they will be treated fairly and get value for their dollars. So while the billable hour is far from dead, many Triangle firms, those based locally as well as regional and national firms with bases in Raleigh and Research Triangle Park, are placing more emphasis on offering AFAs to remain competitive in the crowded marketplace for legal services. And this change comes at a time when the Triangle's competition in the legal field is stiffening. Just this year, national plaintiffs firm Cohen, Milstein, Sellers & Toll and Milwaukee-based Michael Best and Friedrich moved into the market, and both offer AFAs. While work billed outside the realm of an hourly rate still accounts for a much smaller percentage than by the billable hour, it's not just small businesses and startups that are demanding that firms think differently when it comes to pricing. And how well firms are prepared for the continuing shift may have a direct correlation to their ability to win work and to achieve profitability. If the clients want it, you better do it, Clay says. If clients are asking for it, you can't say no or you risk losing the work, By far the biggest driver of AFAs is what the client wants. Law firms change to meet demand. Brian Parker of Parker Poe, which has 8 offices in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Washington, D.C., echoes this sentiment. We're a professional services firm. Our clients dictate how we charge them and how we have relationships economically with them going forward, says Parker, whose practice involves many life sciences clients. The recession focused businesses on managing all expenses. In the context of outside legal services, that translated into a focus on the absolute amount and predictability of fees and on efficient delivery, says Smith Anderson's Roach. Clients are looking for excellent service at a fair and reasonable, predictable price. AFAs are one way to achieve that delicate balance and so have become particularly interesting to business clients with substantial external legal spends. For instance, a company that has regularly occurring high-stakes litigation with legal fees of $2 million to $3 million for each case and multiple cases occurring at one time may be well-suited for working out a flat fee arrangement. I think that it makes legal practice management easier for both the client and the firm, having a targeted budget broken down by segments of that work so that you can check in along the way and know where you're at, says Jennifer Fox, an RTP-based attorney at intellectual property firm Brinks, Gilson, and Leone. With the billable hour, she says, you're typically talking about value after the work is over rather than value from the beginning. In our field, companies that send out a lot of prosecution work, trademark or patent work, it would be very surprising to see that they're not on some sort of alternative fee arrangements, she adds. Client demand is even driving some lateral lawyer moves from one firm to another or the formation of new firms altogether. This has happened in cases where lawyers feel like they can compete by offering AFAs, but their firms don't necessarily want to take the risk, Clay says, adding that there have been significant firms started in this way. Economic relationships are a big factor for groups that leave firms, Parker says. I can say personally that lawyers that have approached us to leave have suggested that that is one of the primary reasons they're leaving, and that reason being the economics of their practice with where the firm wants to go as compared to where the client wants to be, he adds. Business owners seek cost certainty. While AFAs can be applied to a whole host of client types and issues, certain situations, many evident in the triangle, lend themselves particularly well to flexible billing. Ken Zimmerman, a Chicago-based legal consultant at Zeighauser Group, says that the tech and life sciences fields, which are major drivers of RTP, are among those industry sectors that are perceived as aggressive on requiring specified legal budgets and sometimes outright alternative fee arrangements by name. In terms of life sciences dictating play in the AFA arena, it comes down to, in part, the large volume of litigation against pharma, says Zimmerman, which can often be large class action cases, as well as the data-driven and quantitative approach inherent to these companies. At Smith Anderson, managing partner Roach says the firm frequently uses AFAs in clients engaged in large transactional or litigation matters. These tend to be the most expensive and the least predictable from a legal perspective, so these clients want to manage those dynamics. Clients with recurring similar projects who want to realize efficiencies across similar projects. And clients with tight budgets for smaller projects in areas that are well suited for fixed fees. For example, startups have long used AFAs. As Clay points out, without a doubt, startups and innovators, they often don't have much money, and what they have, they need to put into the business. They want to know up front and need to be clear about fees. They can't afford to have big surprises. Why law firms are changing. For firms, one attraction of winning startup work is that small companies sometimes turn into behemoths, generating more profitable legal work for the firms. And the risk factor, with 9 out of 10 startups failing, may have shifted law firm perspective to AFAs when it comes to startups even more. During the early days of the Silicon Valley hype, notes Clay, there were a lot of law firms that would take an equity interest in lieu of fees. Some people hit it big, but more often than not, they didn't. Clay says, adding that they don't use that trade-off as often anymore. Law firms are not very good at analyzing whether a business is going to make it or not. Parker of Parker Poe uses one example of multidisciplinary pharmaceutical companies that is going to have a high-stakes bet-the-company litigation for the life of the company. Every outcome is critical, he says, and each litigation on its own could mean millions in lawyer fees for the company, which weighs heavily on executive minds. They might look for a portfolio of firms to handle work on a monthly billing arrangement. Another example could be handling the commercialization of a company's product and all of its middle market acquisitions needs on an annualized basis, according to Parker. Christopher Bolin of Womble Carlyle says that while the vast majority of the firm's clients are still on some kind of hourly-based billing, the number of clients in our firm that invoice our services on AFAs is certainly growing, and conversations about those have certainly grown. Bolin says that AFAs have worked very well for the firm when there has been enough regularity and frequency of the work that lawyers and clients develop a rhythm and can achieve both cost savings and efficiencies. According to Clay, the bulk of firms nationally are not proactive when it comes to AFAs. But being proactive in terms of AFAs can be profitable. While only 15.4% of firms surveyed report that non-hourly projects are more profitable than hourly projects, 34.1% of firms that are proactive when it comes to AFAs reported those to be more profitable. Evolve or lose clients. Roach of Smith Anderson says that in light of what the firm has seen in recent years, management has an effort underway to become more proactive in that regard. We have reviewed the use of alternative fees and believe that it is a good tool for having good client service, and so we have an internal effort underway with two partners in charge of that to help us either increase the use of AFAs across practice areas or at least increase the frequency of providing that option to clients, he says. Jerry Sayer, a Raleigh-based attorney at Ward & Smith, focused on employment law and litigation, says that several years ago his firm formed a committee and began analyzing data on the matter. We'll compile as much data as we can, and certainly if there is a long history with a client, that's very helpful, he explains. While he says there's always an aspect of unpredictability with another party's attorney or the government on the other side of the table, he adds that if you look over a large enough period of time and data set, there are going to be trends. For instance, the firm can put together an estimate that, on average, a certain matter is never going to be more than X less than Y. If firms and clients reach an AFA through these means, both sides will do fine, he says. Sayer says, currently, well in excess of 10% of the firm's revenue comes from some sort of AFAs, and that he absolutely expects that to grow. Not only does this work, but this can be a very attractive way of building relationships with clients, he adds. Sayer says increasing the use of AFAs in the legal industry is recognition that everybody needs to make doing business with them as convenient and easy as possible. If you don't evolve, he says, you're going to lose clients. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. McConnell Bell family eye 111-year-old Ross golf course. Looks like there may be some real interesting developments in the golf world that revolve around the Pinehurst and Southern Pines area in Moore County. Southern Pines Golf Club, a Donald Ross-designed 111-year-old course, may be interested in selling. On July 5, Biz hears, the club had an informational meeting with members and potential buyers to talk about operations and fiscal needs moving forward. Presenting in that meeting was John McConnell, owner of McConnell Golf in Raleigh. McConnell is known for his affection for Donald Ross courses. All he would confess to Biz is that the course needs major upgrades. One of the other interested parties in the meeting were owners of the two nationally prominent courses in the same area, Pine Needles and Mid Pines, both Donald Ross courses. Kelly Miller, president of Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club, gave a presentation to the members that included future plans for the Southern Pines course, including moving the fabled Elks Lodge to another site on the property and replacing it with a new clubhouse. Biz also hears there were two other groups there, including well-known local golf course operator Woody Davis of Avestra Golf, which currently leases and operates the Southern Pines course from the Elks Club, owner of the golf club. Folks, if you're a golfer and interested in happenings around the golf mecca in our state, This could be a very big deal. Stay tuned. Airport expansion triggers protests. A group of cyclists, hikers, and outdoor enthusiasts continue to express concerns about a Raleigh-Durham International Airport plan that could eliminate informal trails along Reedy Creek Road. The airport, to fund its bullish $2.7 billion Vision 2040 plan, is considering leasing out land it owns for development. Several options, from offices to a quarry, are being considered. And RDU spokesman Andrew Sawyer says everything is still on the table. In the meantime, people such as Anthony Corvo, president of running group Carolina Godiva Track Club, are pleading with airport officials for an alternative. It just seems like there's a little too much development packed into one area, and I just don't see the need to have more office space when we have RTP right here, Corvo says. Corvo, among the attendees of a public workshop on the plan's finances July 10, is also concerned about his neighborhood. He and fellow runner Shannon Johnstone live on the other side of the lake in RDU's plans. Johnstone says flooding is already happening, a side effect of nearby apartment construction. More and more development is going to hurt the wildlife in that area and mean more flooding, she predicts. Jane Pauley headlines evening of a Hope Gala. The Foundation of Hope for Research and Treatment of Mental Illness, founded by Thad and Alice Ure, has landed another star MC for its upcoming Evening of Hope Gala. This year, it's award-winning journalist and author Jane Pauley, now host of CBS Sunday Morning. The Evening of Hope Gala is designed to help fund research projects in search of cures and better treatments for a host of mental illnesses. The funds raised will go toward mental health research at UNC Chapel Hill, as well as community groups serving the Triangle. The event will be held September 13 at the Angus Barn Pavilion and will feature live and silent auctions and a five-course dinner prepared by Chef Walter Royal. Last year's fundraiser featured actress Ashley Judd as Master of Ceremonies. Boy Scouts honor SAS employee for volunteer work. Explore Post 50's teen-led broadcast team, documenting all the plays in action at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, turned their cameras to one of their own at the June 24 game as the Boy Scouts of America bestowed one of its highest honors to Post 50 advisor and mentor Ken Bland. Bland, a career SAS employee, was awarded the William H. Spurgeon III Award. Bland has been volunteering with Post 50, which utilizes its youth-based intern program to produce all of the live broadcast feeds for home games of the Durham Bulls since its inception in 1998. He's also been a mentor for Post 50 since moving to the Triangle in 1984. That provides job shadowing opportunities for teens interested in broadcast careers. Want to be a leader? Know how to play defense. Biz was sifting through some data at the North Carolina Secretary of State's office when it ran across documents for Defense LLC. Turns out that's the name of a consulting company for Duke University basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski. Cool name. After all, Coach K's teams have long been known for tough defense. Duke tops local schools in terms of LGBTQ rank. Duke University is among the 50 best colleges for LGBTQ students, according to a new ranking by independent website College Choice. The university was the only one in North Carolina to crack the list, clocking in at number 12. After determining what are the best schools for LGBTQ students, we also took a look at statistics to ensure high student retention rates, as well as general academic and professional success of students at these schools, says Christian Amundsen, managing editor of College Choice. Outside of academic life, Duke is also frequently lauded for its queer-sensitive campus safety measures, its LGBTQ student recruitment and retention efforts, and its holistic student health plans, states College Choice in its ranking. Princeton University, followed by MIT, and the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire took the top three spots in the ranking, respectively. The ranking was based on data from the Campus Pride Index and U.S. News & World Report, among other sources. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, End of an era for Scientific Properties with sale of Durham's Golden Belt campus. Scientific Properties, once one of the most active real estate investors in historic properties in downtown Durham, has sold its last major real estate asset with the sale of the Golden Belt campus on Main Street for nearly $19.5 million. LRC Properties of Rye Brook, New York, has purchased the six buildings on the Golden Belt campus from an affiliate of Scientific Properties, according to Durham County Records. The deal had been months in the making, but for Scientific Properties CEO Gary Cooper, the deal has been years in the making, ever since he was hired to take over asset management of the portfolio following the relocation to New York City of Scientific Properties founder Andrew Rothschild in 2008. Over the last couple of years, Cooper has helped facilitate the sale of the former Elkins Chrysler auto dealership, now the site of the future 555 Mangum office tower and 12-story Van Allen Apartments building, the Venable Center office complex, and Golden Belt, Scientific Properties' crowning achievement that involved the complete redevelopment of the former Golden Belt Manufacturing Company factory campus on Main Street. I was fortunate to have investors who could also envision Durham's future and had the fortitude to stick with it through the recession, Cooper says. It's been amazing to see Durham thrive and grow since then. Rothschild's investor group still owns the Heritage Square Retail Center on Lakewood Avenue, and Cooper says he will continue to oversee its management, but his office for Scientific Properties is closing. I'm going to be doing my own projects now, he says, and looking for opportunities. Demolition crews make way for a 10-story building on Glenwood Avenue in downtown Raleigh. Behind the construction fencing at the corner of two of downtown Raleigh's busiest streets in the Glenwood South District, crews are tearing down what's left of a medical office building. Soon to rise in its place will be a 10-story, $86 million office building called One Glenwood, which developer Ryan Blair envisions will become a new focal point connecting Glenwood South and the Warehouse District. "We're only lacking a couple of pieces of paperwork to get it all started," says Blair, Vice President of Development and Acquisitions at Maryland-based Heritage Properties, which acquired the site at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Hillsborough Street in late 2015 and took it through final city approval last year. Market demand and prospective tenant interest has been strong, and in order to meet some key prospects, timelines, we are moving forward with this site, he says. In addition to the 9 floors of office space, One Glenwood will have about 15,000 square foot of retail and a parking deck for 730 cars. Once construction commences, One Glenwood will be ready for occupancy in about 18 months. Blair anticipates the first tenants being able to move in by late 2018. North Hills debuts high-end apartment community. Competition among the Triangle's luxury apartment market has heated up with the opening of the first phase of units at North Hills' new 16-story Park Central mixed-use building. The $100 million project, a joint venture between Kane Realty Corporation of Raleigh and California-based KBS Realty Advisors, is one of the most expensive new development projects to date on the east side of Six Forks Road at North Hills. Park Central's first tenants began moving in June 10, and community manager Lauren Bass says leasing is already ahead of schedule at 6.3% occupancy and 152 units finished. YMCA closing gym. The YMCA of the Triangle announced to its members in a letter in early July that it will be closing its fitness gym and group classes at The Factory as of July 23. The Factory co-owner Richard Robbins of New York says it only took one phone call to find a replacement tenant for the 20,000 square foot space. Raleigh-based fitness club operator O2 Fitness will be relocating its 6,000 square foot gym in Wake Forest to The Factory. New hotels reach milestones in downtown Raleigh, downtown Durham. After years of anticipation and planning, developers of two hotels, one in downtown Raleigh and one in downtown Durham, are making final touches to their new properties opening to guests in July. The 10-story Residence Inn Raleigh Downtown Hotel on Salisbury Street in downtown Raleigh officially welcomed its first guests on July 6. Following close on its heels will be the new Unscripted Durham Hotel, on track to open July 19. And now we turn to the On Tech and Banking page, written by Lauren Onosorge. The first headline, Denver concern moves HQ to Durham. Colorado software innovator Prescient is moving its headquarters from Arvada in the Denver metro to downtown Durham. Its executive chairman, Satyen Patel, announced the news July 12 at the grand opening of its new Mebane manufacturing facility and says the millennial talent pool helped the firm pick Durham over Georgia and South Carolina. The biggest reason we're doing this here is the universities, the ecosystem, he says. It's a vibrant architectural community. We never had a problem attracting talent in Denver, and we don't anticipate any problem in Durham. When the Durham office officially opens on North Duke Street downtown, it will have about 20 employees. Every senior function is moving here, he says. Corporate financing is moving here. Operations is moving here. And he's had zero pushback from his executive team, he says. They like the company and they like the culture, he explains. Within the next year, he expects to add 25 to 35 new employees to the Durham space, which has the capacity for about 65. Patel says Prescient had been looking for space in Durham for the past year, signing a lease quietly about 2 months ago. Downtown Durham is 98% occupied, and we were very, very fortunate to get this space, he says, adding that his team snapped it up before it went on the market. We took it without asking questions. The remaining challenge? Finding developer partners so it can transform its technology into buildings. Its five-dimensional software can design apartment buildings up to 16 stories tall. Its manufacturing outfit can print the parts from trusses to panels. With each come with QR codes construction crews use to assemble the structures on site. The new Mebane plant, like its other facility in Denver, has the capacity to produce 5.4 million square feet of buildings per year. Prescient's sweet spot is multifamily, whether it's a hotel, a student housing project, an apartment community, or a senior living complex. Buy means opportunity for Rocky Mount Bank. As out-of-state banks continue to buy their way into the Triangle market share through acquisitions, a Rocky Mount-based community bank is moving in. First Carolina Bank is based in Rocky Mount, but has its executive team, including CEO Ron Day, based on Raleigh's Glenwood Avenue. There, it's planning to open its first Raleigh full-service branch at what has just been a loan production office for the past 2 years. Day says the slew of recent bank buys add to his institution's appeal, and Day is bullish about his firm's prospects in Raleigh. I expect we'll be pushing toward $300 million before the end of the third quarter, he says. Its new Raleigh branch opens July 17. Clean energy industry means $18 billion for North Carolina. A new report shows the clean energy industry, from solar to wind, has contributed nearly $18 billion in economic impact to North Carolina's economy over the past decade. A report by RTI International, commissioned by the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, finds 114,000 full-time equivalent positions have been associated with the industry, which between 2007 and 2016 meant $9 billion in direct clean energy investment. The report also finds that the state's most rural communities benefit the most, with Duplin, Robeson, and Catawba counties experiencing between $300 million and $750 million in clean energy project investments since 2007. The report comes as wind developers, including Apex Clean Energy, which is planning a 105-turbine farm in Chowan and Perkiomen's counties, are threatening to suspend projects over a wind moratorium. The wind moratorium passed in both the state and the state house and Senate and would prohibit new permits for wind projects for 18 months. Why Infosys picked the Triangle for 2,000 jobs? Infosys's decision to bring a tech hub to Wake County, creating 2,000 jobs, was the result of an aggressive recruitment campaign by the state, and the odds were stacked against us at the beginning, say multiple officials close to the deal, codenamed Project Element. By the time the state really started its negotiations with the Indian IT firm, Virginia and Maryland had emerged as frontrunners for the project, says Commerce Secretary Anthony Copeland. Governors from both of those states had already met with Infosys, which is why Governor Roy Cooper was tapped for the first of what would be two in-person visits with Infosys executives that first week, he says. The final decision happened very recently and came down to talent. Ravi Kumar, president and deputy chief operating officer of Infosys, says the workforce Copeland's team was selling was too enticing to pass up. He calls Raleigh one of the most diverse innovation hubs in the country. Kumar visited the area three times, taking part in multiple meetings and calls with the governor and other officials. Two business leader delegations met with Infosys during the recruitment process, Kumar says. It was the emotional quotient needed to close this deal faster, he explains. The state has approved the company for a $22.3 million jobs development investment grant if it meets its hiring goals. The company will receive an additional $3 million from the North Carolina Community College System. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the page written by Jennifer Henderson on life sciences. Why Alchemy is moving corporate headquarters to the Triangle. Wilmington-based contract development and manufacturing organization Alchemy, which rebranded to its current name last year after the 2013 merger of AAI Pharma Services and Cambridge Major Laboratories, will be moving a planned headquarters expansion from Wilmington to the Triangle area, according to President and CEO Stephen Kutzer. While the expansion was originally planned for Wilmington as the company's existing base and from a sheer size perspective, Alchemy has decided to move its headquarters to the Triangle. It currently has a location in Durham in order to enable necessary recruitment and growth in terms of highly technical areas and to be situated in a hub of the pharmaceutical industry crucial to attracting investors and customers, says Kutzer. We want to make the Research Triangle one of our hotspots in terms of investment in the future, he says. The company currently employs about 50 people at its location in Durham, according to Kutzer, about 450 in Wilmington, and more than 1,000 company-wide. He says Alchemy plans to lease a new space in the Triangle and move into its new headquarters sometime next year. The company will be adding between 100 and 150 new jobs in the area, he says, in terms of senior leadership positions and expertise for new biologics operations. Even with the headquarters move, Kutzer says Alchemy intends to keep its Wilmington headcount up and even expand there, possibly up to 500 employees in the near future. Outside of Wilmington and Durham, Alchemy has facilities in Charleston, South Carolina, Edison, New Jersey, St. Louis, Missouri, Germantown, Wisconsin, and the Netherlands. While Alchemy's previously planned headquarters expansion in Wilmington was valued at about $16 million and included state and local incentives, including a $50,000 grant from the state's One North Carolina Fund, its headquarters move and expansion in the Triangle does not involve any local incentives at this point, says Kutzer, and will require limited capital and investment, with many facilities with laboratory and administrative space available for lease. Alchemy is a portfolio company of private equity firm Aris Capital. Kutzer says Alchemy has annual revenue of upward of $250 million and has historically seen double-digit growth. Locus gets investment from China's Tencent. Research Triangle Park-based Locus Biosciences has secured a $5 million convertible note, and Chinese technology giant Tencent Holdings Limited, which recently bought a 5% stake in electric car maker Tesla, has led the financing round, which also included the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. We're really excited to be pairing up with a group like Tencent, says Locus CEO Paul Garofalo. They're investing in things that have the potential to really change the future course of humanity. Locus, a biotechnology company spun out from NC State University, was founded in 2015 and is using CRISPR-Cas3 technology to develop antimicrobials aimed at targeting antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections. Garofalo says he expects the new funding to take us into the fall of 2018, with proceeds being used to advance a first asset to investigational new drug, IND, submission to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. He said Locus expects to be in human trials by the first half of 2019. Locus currently has 9 full-time employees and has raised about $7 million to date, according to Garofalo. Morrisville Company to split into 2 entities. Morrisville's Tyra Tech, which trades on the AIM market of the London Stock Exchange, is looking for growth through a new licensing deal and plans to split into 2 separate entities. The company, known for its Vamousse head lice treatments sold in major retailers such as Walmart, CVS, Walgreens, and Rite Aid, has announced that its joint venture with American Vanguard Corporation called Invance Technologies has inked a development and licensing agreement with, quote, a major global consumer products company, unquote, for household pest control products using Tyratech's technologies. And in May, Tyratech disclosed that its board had decided that the company's intellectual property and products should be separated into 2 entities, human health and animal health. In terms of financial benefit of the new licensing deal, it will be more in the long term, says CEO Dr. Bruce Jackdell. According to Tyratech, it stands to receive a small share of the profit of Invance, in addition to associated royalties and an additional upfront cash fee of $500,000, which will be used to fund normal working capital. As for plans to split Tyratech into 2 separate entities, Jackdell says the company needs additional investment to completely capture all of its growth potential. Because the human health and animal health segments of Tyratech's business are very different, the company is likely targeting different types of investments, he says. This is a process that we are currently pursuing very aggressively. Our target is before the end of the year. Tyratech saw revenue of $8.4 million in 2016, up from $7.4 million the year prior. Net loss for 2016 was $2.3 million, last year the same as in 2015. And finally, we have a section called She Said It, the quote, Inc. Research's investigative site strategy aligns with our long-term view of how clinical development will evolve, where reliable technology and increased access to data means investigative sites will increasingly work with multiple providers. And that's from Tracy Gashi, Executive Director, Site and Patient Access at Inc. Research, on the company's new site network focused on psychiatry. And now we turn to the On Education and Research page, written by Daniel Kemptob. How DeVos's delay of the student debt rule affects North Carolina. North Carolina students hoping for clarity on student debt forgiveness could be in the dark indefinitely as state attorneys general and the U.S. Department of Education battle over a newly delayed regulation. The borrower's defense rule was slated to go into effect July 1, but U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos announced last month that she would delay its implementation. The regulation, adopted after the Department of Education saw an uptick in loan forgiveness applications following the collapse of for-profit college chain Corinthian Colleges, would have clarified the process that allows borrowers at fraudulent colleges to have their loans forgiven. While no Corinthian school campuses were located in North Carolina, Austin Vervuca, a spokesman for the North Carolina Justice Department, says over 10,000 North Carolina residents had taken classes through the company and were eligible for student loan forgiveness. He says delaying the rule will make the application process more difficult for around 2,000 of those borrowers who were not eligible for a more streamlined process to loan forgiveness but are able to apply for borrower's defense to repayment. North Carolina students who are applying for this relief are back in a murky, opaque land where it's not clear what the department is doing with their applications, says Jason Pickler, a staff attorney for the Consumer Protection and Housing Project at the North Carolina Justice Center. The law also prevented schools from banning class action lawsuits and requiring students to sign arbitration agreements. But Roger Kleitz, creative director and president of Living Arts College in Raleigh, says these regulations are discriminatory against the for-profit college industry. Numerous for-profit colleges, including some in North Carolina, were subject to increased scrutiny under the Obama administration. The ITT Technical Institutes, which had campuses nationally, including four in North Carolina, closed their doors in September after the Department of Education banned the company from enrolling new students using federal financial aid. The DOE cut off funding for Charlotte Law School in December after finding it had failed to adequately prepare students for the bar exam and had misled prospective students on bar passage rates. NC Attorney General Josh Stein joined 18 other state attorneys general July 6 in a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Education and DeVos in opposition to the rule's delay. U.S. Census estimates show a lagging rural North Carolina. As North Carolina metropolitan areas experience unprecedented growth, some rural areas are rapidly declining, new U.S. Census Bureau estimates reveal. Researchers at Carolina Demography, part of UNC Chapel Hill's Carolina Population Center, analyzed municipality population data from the latest U.S. Census estimates. Their report found that the populations of 225 of North Carolina's 553 municipalities decreased from 2010 to 2016, most in rural areas. The top 10 municipalities with the largest percentage of population declines were all located in Bertie, Northampton, and Washington counties. Rebecca Tippett, director of Carolina Demography, says the northeastern region of the state is at a disadvantage compared to other rural areas because of its distance from the state's urban hubs. And as the populations in these areas dwindle, the existing residents age. 23% of Northampton County's population is over 65, compared to 16% of the statewide population. North Carolina lawmakers fund food manufacturing center. Kannapolis, a city once marred by the shuttering of textile mills, is set to become a leader of the emerging food manufacturing sector thanks to a $5 million budget provision. The funds will equip the Food Processing Innovation Center, which will be housed at the North Carolina Research Campus in Kannapolis, NC State University's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services are taking the helm in the creation of the center, set to open in 2018. The funds will go toward building a GMP-compliant plant on the site, meaning not only can the on-site scientists conduct research, but companies can actually produce and sell new food products. Say a company wanted to test three varieties of a new pizza that's being created, says Richard Linton, dean of the NCSU College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. They could come in, produce it within the facility, and then they could, in fact, serve it and consume it. An economic feasibility study conducted in 2014 for the state legislature showed food manufacturing has the potential to add $10.1 billion to the economy and 38,000 jobs. The budget mandates the creation of an advisory committee to oversee the creation of the center, chaired by the Commissioner of Agriculture. The committee will meet in early July to draw up plans. What you need to know about UNC system professor pay. As professor salaries recover from the recession at universities around the country, UNC system schools are failing to keep pace. Triangle Business Journal recently looked at 10 years of compensation from the Chronicle of Higher Education's full-time faculty salary database for 15 UNC system campuses. The data revealed that over the course of 10 years, while professor pay was on an incline from 2005 to 2010, from 2010 to 2015, faculty salaries at UNC system schools have decreased by an average of 0.27%, compared to the average 7.8% growth in the national average for four-year public institutions. Professors at the UNC system's flagship universities fared slightly better, but still lagged behind their peers. In 5 years, full-time professor salaries at UNC Chapel Hill have increased 3.12%, and at NC State University, just 1.71%. UNC Chapel Hill, NCSU, and UNC Charlotte all had average professor salaries higher than the national average for four-year public universities. UNC Pembroke, NC Central University, and UNC Greensboro have experienced the biggest salary reductions since 2010. And now we turn to A Better World, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Focused on Literacy for Local Kids and Families. In 2011, seeing a gap in kids' access to books based on their parents' income, Ginger Young tested an idea. She asked friends and colleagues to donate their own children's books. In return, she promised to distribute them to children who otherwise might not get a chance to read or own a book. Within 2 weeks, her garage was stocked with bags and boxes filled with 6,000 books. By the end of the month, donations had grown to 10,000. That was the start of Book Harvest, a Durham nonprofit that now has distributed nearly 700,000 books through home visits to families with newborn babies and through schools, nonprofits, and other partners. Operating with an annual budget of $728,000, 8 full-time employees, and nearly 500 volunteers, Book Harvest works to get books into the hands of children up to age 18 and to promote literacy for kids and families. It also is developing plans to serve more people with its own programs and find ways for other communities to adopt those programs. And it is heading a collaborative effort in Durham that is part of a national initiative in more than 300 communities to improve reading proficiency by the end of third grade. Book Harvest gears its delivery of books and literacy support to a child's age. Through referrals from partner agencies such as Durham Connect, a nursing home visiting program, Book Harvest enrolls newborns and their families in its Book Babies program, which provides them with books and offers literacy coaching for parents. To address the challenge of summer learning loss for students while school is out, Book Harvest offers Books on Break, a program that provides 10 free books at the end of the school year that the children select themselves at 44 public schools in Durham, Orange, and Chatham counties and the Chapel Hill Carrboro system. Once a week, through its community book bank, it also stocks shelves it has set up in the waiting rooms of about 65 partner organizations, such as social service agencies, health clinics, and after-school and tutoring programs, mainly in Durham and Orange counties, where children can select books to build home libraries. And at Books to Go events, which it hosts 3 times per year, teachers and officials from about 80 schools and nonprofits who work with middle and high school students can pick books from which students can select on their own and keep. This year, Book Harvest also launched a service that sends text messages twice per week to parents who subscribe, offering tips on reading to children and on summer reading opportunities at libraries and other locations. Partnerships are central to Book Harvest work, says Young, founder and executive director of Book Harvest. In partnership with the Durham Housing Authority and Durham County Library, for example, Book Harvest aims to make sure every child that lives in each of DHA's 8 housing communities has a big stack of books next to their bed. Children's opportunity to get books, Young says, should not be connected to how much money their parents make. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline on his column, Jewel in Danger of Losing Its Shine. Just a few days ago, we heard the Research Triangle Foundation, owner of one of the world's most prominent research parks, Research Triangle Park, has severed its ties with its real estate developer, Hines. While details were limited as to what happened, it is clear that Hines and the board of the foundation may have had some disagreements about the direction of the development of Park Center, the first phase of what was touted as the urbanization of the park. History shows us that RTP, along with the local universities, played the premier role in developing the region as an economic powerhouse. Sustained influence from the likes of IBM, Glaxo, RTI International, and a few others resulted in thousands of new jobs, economic activity, and worldwide prominence. But the park's model is dated. It is sprawled across thousands of acres and is littered with campus-like buildings that host workers during the day only to see them drive away after the workday. It has limited residential, retail, and arts and entertainment options for thousands that work in the park every day. Enter the move to create a new master plan for the park and look ahead 50 years. A well-known local executive, Bob Giolis, was hired to work with the RTP board and real estate developers to come with a plan supported by public and private money. At one point, people were talking about a $2 billion facelift, primarily fronted by the private sector. Well, that was some 3 years ago. Park officials did purchase the Park Center property for $17 million in 2014 to develop a mixed-use project full of residences, retail, and entertainment options. They also hired Hines to oversee the development. Now, Hines is gone, and so is Giolis, the frontman of the expansive RTP master plan. So are we back to the drawing board now? Is the RTP board second-guessing the master plan? The fact is, in terms of mixed-use development, RTP faces stiff competition from well-established areas such as downtowns in Raleigh and Durham, North Hills, Centennial Campus, Weston Parkway, and others. Companies such as MetLife, Citrix, and Red Hat chose areas closest to homes, shops, and entertainment centers. RTP needs to add residential and retail development now if they want to attract the new generation of companies filled with 20-something-year-old workers. The RTF's new vision and master plan identifies areas to create clustered developments within the park that will become the new format for RTP's expansion, a Hines press release read back in 2014. Development is slated to begin in 12 to 18 months, it said. Those talks of transformation from the board, staff, and project partners were rampant a few years ago. We don't hear about them anymore. And frankly, I'm not even sure companies looking into the area for relocation even consider RTP as a viable option anymore. The goal to create this master plan and go full steam ahead with development was not only necessary, but was essential if RTP were to survive in today's world. But losing 3 years now has made matters worse. We hear the foundation will soon announce a new CEO who, I am assuming, will be in charge of hiring the next real estate developer to work on Park Center. The current economic expansion in the U.S. already has lasted 96 months, now the third longest in U.S. history, in 33 business cycles going back to 1854, notes a recent Goldman Sachs report. Obviously, the question then becomes, just how long will this expansion last? I mention this only because I keep thinking, did RTP miss a trick with this delay? I hope not. I still consider RTP the crown jewel of business for the Triangle region. And we'll also read a viewpoint concerning the state budget, headlined North Carolina's Self-Inflicting Revenue Challenge. And it's written by Alexandra Forder Sirota, who is the director of the NC Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center. The final North Carolina budget includes a package of tax cuts that reduce available revenue by a total of $528 million over the two-year budget period. However, the full cost of the tax cuts will reduce available annual revenue by around $900 million, and this reality is not included or apparent in the budget because the tax cuts are set to kick in starting January 2019. The fiscal year for North Carolina's state budget runs from July to June, which means the fiscal impact of the tax cuts included in the budget will only apply to the second half of fiscal year 2019, January through June 2019, in this budget. The combined and full impact of the tax changes will reduce available annual revenue by $900 million. However, lawmakers were not required to account for $400 million of this cost in the new budget because of the way tax cuts were phased in, obscuring the full cost of the tax cuts from the public. The latest package of tax cuts builds on to tax cuts that lawmakers have passed since 2013 that, when totaled, result in an estimated $3.5 billion reduction in annual revenue. These tax cuts have largely benefited the highest income earners in the state and profitable corporations. Under tax cuts since 2013, the top 1% of income earners in the state, whose average income is $1 million, gets a permanent tax cut of nearly $22,000 on average. By contrast, middle-income taxpayers get a tax cut of $226 on average, while the lowest income earners in the state get a tax cut of only $16 on average. The new budget keeps North Carolina on a path that only heightens the challenge of meeting the needs of a growth state. Tax cuts in the budget, which build on to those passed since 2013, have greatly reduced the level of available revenue for public investments. Consequently, this self-inflicted revenue challenge has allowed lawmakers to lower their expectations in regards to what is possible for the state and has created a budgetary landscape based on false choices in which chosen public investments are funded at the expense of others. And for our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Kellen Moore, CEO of the John Rex Endowment. Kellen Moore, currently the executive director of CareShare Health Alliance in Mooresville, was named the next CEO of the John Rex Endowment, effective in mid-August. The move marks the only such change at the top spot for the organization. Her role is to provide leadership to further the vision of the John Rex Endowment to improve the health and well-being of Wake County's vulnerable children. Responsibilities include operation of the foundation, prudent investment of endowment funds, and leading mission-related dialogue, vision, and direction at national, state, and county levels. The John Rex Endowment works to award grants to nonprofit organizations to support an environment where children and families in Greater Wake County live healthy lives. Since 2001, more than $45 million has been awarded in grants from the John Rex Endowment. And we'll stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen the next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.